The time has come to make these things public because we have now exhausted our administrative remedies. If you are not a lawyer, you may not realize that you cannot simply walk into court and sue someone at will, especially if that someone is the United States government. You must establish that you at least have a valid basis for going to court, or the court will not hear the case. The purpose of this is to prevent abuse of the courts through frivolous lawsuits, suits for harassment, and so forth. In the case of the federal government, suit cannot be brought until you have exhausted your administrative remedies. This is the general rule. That is, until you have given the appropriate agencies of the federal government an opportunity to redress your grievances. This we have now done. We have now gone to Congress. We have gone to the Treasury. We have gone to the Justice Department. We have gone to the General Accounting Office. And we have gone to the top of this Administrative Accounting Office, the Comptroller General of the United States. We have corresponded, and we have held meetings. We have petitioned. We have pressured. We have asked for answers. And we have received silence, evasions, and half-truths. We have given information, and it has not been used. We have explored every avenue available to us for more than a year. And my friends, the Fort Knox gold scandal has not been cleared up in any way, just the opposite. To give just one example, there is an official document obtained by us from the United States Mint with great difficulty some time ago, entitled Gold Shipments from United States Bullion Depository, Fort Knox, Kentucky, January 1, 1961 to June 30, 1974. Based on our own strictly confidential information and with pictures, we were able recently to ask the following question of the United States Mint under circumstances in which they were under great pressure to give us a reply. Our question was, quote, what was shipped in the four tractor trailer loads on January 20, 1965 from Fort Knox to railroad yards across the river to Jeffersonville, Indiana? This shipment does not show, my friends, on the official listing I named a moment ago. Yet here is the astonishing answer contained in a letter from Mrs. Mary Brooks, the director of the United States Mint, dated June 19, 1975, and I quote, on January 20, 1965, 1,762,381.353 fine ounces of gold from the Fort Knox Bullion Depository was shipped by way of rail from Jeffersonville, Indiana, to the United States Assay Office, New York, New York, unquote. There is no explanation as to why this nearly 2 million-ounce shipment does not appear on the official listing. But this violent conflict among their own statements is only typical of the entire Fort Knox fiasco. A year ago, the chairman of the privately owned Federal Reserve System, Dr. Arthur Burns, admitted in a letter to Congressman John Rarick that the assets of the Federal Reserve does not include gold. And yet, at the same time, official statements of the Federal Reserve did list gold as a prime asset, and they still do today. This discrepancy has never been cleared up, Congress taking a ho-hum attitude about it all. The only concrete result so far is that Congressman Rarick, who had been very popular with his constituents, was washed out of office last November with a sea of Rockefeller campaign funds which went to all of his opponents. It so happens that the aforementioned private owners of the Federal Reserve System are the Rockefeller interests, and they react very vigorously whenever anyone dares to poke around at this keystone of their economic empire. Yes, the time has come to go to court. And while I must still save my actual evidence for court, the time has come to let you, the American people, the jury, on exactly what has been done and how. The foundations were laid for the Fort Knox gold scandal during World War II, when extensive hush-hush modifications were made to the Fort Knox gold depository. Originally, the Fort Knox gold depository building was designed around a huge vault with two levels, the ground floor and the basement. One entered the building through the front entrance you have probably seen often in pictures, passed through a vestibule, and found himself in a corridor running to left and right. This same corridor went all the way around the building on all four sides of a huge vault. To reach the vault door, one would enter the building at the front entrance, follow the corridor to the right, and then continue on around the corner and along the right side of the building. Partway down this corridor, one would come to the vault door, which was on the left or inner side of the corridor. On entering through the vault door, one found himself in another corridor inside the vault. Fronting on this corridor were a series of storage compartments about the size of jail cells, I call them bird cages, but with solid metal doors with individual locks on them. These cells or compartments were arranged in a sort of cell block, with the vault corridor passing all the way around it. That is, one could head off down this corridor inside the vault, walk around a center cell block with compartment doors facing onto the corridor on all four sides, and finally wind up where he started. There were 20 of these jail cell-like storage compartments inside the vault on the first floor of the vault. There were also stairs with which one could walk down to the basement level of the vault, and the arrangement at the basement level was the same, a square cell block of 20 compartments fronting on a corridor which went all the way around. What I have tried to describe so far was the main or outer vault. However, it was not where the gold was kept. These small compartments, 40 in all, were for the storage of all sorts of other things, secret documents, precious metals other than gold, and a variety of other things. But these were not where the gold was kept. Instead, there was a sort of vault within a vault, known as the Central Core Vault, which was reserved strictly for the storage of gold. Access to the Central Core Vault, which was located centrally and below ground, could only be obtained from a point at the basement level inside the outer vault structure I have described. Moving gold in and out of the Central Core Vault was therefore a relatively slow and tedious process. But in the 1942-43 time period, major modifications were made to the Fort Knox vault structure under the direction of a mechanical engineer named Stanley Tatum, who was serving as an Army major at that time. A rapid retrieval system for the gold was built in the rear of the depository building, where there are a pair of huge doors into which trucks can back for loading and unloading. First, the six birdcage compartments running along the rear of the outer vault on each floor were deleted. The vault corridors, which had formerly gone all the way around the cell block on each floor, were then walled off where the row of compartments along the rear had been deleted. Thus, the vault corridors no longer went all the way around, but now formed a U configuration with the base of the U turned toward the front of the depository building. By lopping off the rear portion of the outer vault in this manner, space was created in the rear to accommodate the rapid retrieval system. In this space, in the center adjacent to the truck doors, was installed a powerful screw-type elevator, passing from the ground floor down and to the level of the Central Core Vault, into which the elevator gave access. At the top of the elevator, that is, at the ground level in the rear of the depository building, a massive vault door was installed. In effect, this vault door serves as nothing but a very elaborate elevator door, since the only thing you can enter in when you open it is the elevator, which then takes you down to the central core vault where all gold is supposed to be stored. Finally, the original access to the central core vault from a location in the two-level main vault where the compartments are was deleted. The building's interior walls and decor were then restored to something like their original appearance. But now, thanks to the secret modifications, there is no longer a vault within a vault arrangement. Instead, there are now two separate and independent vaults. One is the vault with all the jail cell-like compartments in it, which was shown to the visitors last September. The other vault, which cannot be reached from within the vault the visitors saw, is the gold vault, the central core vault, which can be reached only by the elevator in the rear of the building. The compartments in the vault shown to the visitors were never intended for storage of gold. And, my friends, what the visitors saw last September were not gold bars, not even junk gold. It has now been confirmed to my satisfaction that what was seen by the visitors is a commodity known as show gold, lead bars covered with a layer of gold that is just thick enough to stand up under handling. This even helps explain the high alloy content responsible for the strange redness which many of the visitors last September noticed. Pure gold is extremely soft, and a thin layer over lead could all too easily be damaged and reveal the lead underneath. Highly alloyed gold, that is, impure gold, was therefore used so that it would withstand handling. Thus, they saw junk gold, all right, but it wasn't even junk gold all the way through. The visitors of Fort Knox last September, of course, had no way of knowing that there are two vaults, and no one told them. They were led to believe that the vault they entered with all the compartments was the vault, and the treasury had seen to it that none of the invited visitors were experts on gold, much less on the mysterious, legendary place known as Fort Knox. The closest brush the visitors had with stumbling onto the truth came when a reporter asked Mrs. Mary Brooks, the director of the Mint, why the compartments were numbered in such a curious fashion, 1 to 14 on one floor, and 21 to 34 on the other. Mrs. Brooks helpfully replied that she didn't know. Well, Mary, if you haven't figured it out by now, I'll tell you. The missing numbers 15 to 20 and 35 to 40 are those of the cells that were deleted in the secret modifications during the 1942-43 time period. After the wartime modifications to Fort Knox were made, over 10 years were allowed to pass before the next major step in 1954. At that time, a super-secret complete inventory was taken of the Fort Knox gold. This was not the same as a relatively cursory audit, so-called, of the gold which was done in 1953. The project in 1954 involved a complete count, with weighing and assay sampling of all the gold there, about 750,400-ounce bars worth a total of $12 billion at that time, and that was at the old price of $35 per ounce. That's twice as much as the Treasury ever claims to have now, and even these claims are complete lies. In addition to all the weighing, counting, and checking against records, the 1954 inventory included the extraction of a plug of gold from every 100th bar for assaying. And these samples were sent to assay offices all around the country to minimize the chance of any collusion to falsify the results. This seemingly enormous job was kept completely secret, and was completed in only 9 weeks. All of the gold was, of course, in the central core vault at that time. None was in the bird cage compartments. The contrast with the so-called GAO audit of the Fort Knox gold last fall can hardly be overstated. The alleged gold stock in 1974 was only half as large, and they can only claim to have examined about 20% of that. Assay samples were only taken from only about every thousandth bar. They were not plugged, but merely small chips were taken, which could be taken from a corner, say, without cutting through into the lead underneath. All the 99 samples were sent to a single location, the New York Assay Office, and only 54 of these have ever been stated to have been returned with undefined results. Finally, the results of the alleged 1974 GAO audit, which was performed, by the way, by 13 Treasury employees and only 2 GAO representatives, have never been published. The closest thing to it is a ridiculous little document printed in February 1975, which presents no findings of fact concerning the gold and timidly says only we believe that gold is there. By returning to the 1954 gold inventory, the question arises, why was it a secret? After all, the law requires an annual physical inventory of the nation's gold reserves. This law has been generally circumvented and ignored. But one would think that when its requirements were satisfied for once in 1954, the fact would have been made public. The reason for the secrecy of the comprehensive 1954 inventory, my friends, is that its purpose was not that defined by law. Instead, the Rockefeller interests were simply taking stock of the American gold reserves, which they intended to start spiriting away a few years later. In about 1960, after those who had worked on the secret 1954 inventory were safely gone from Fort Knox, the next step was taken. A system of record keeping was set up to allegedly keep track of the gold by means of special ribbon-like metal seals on the doors of the compartments in the main vault, not where gold is supposed to be stored at all. These seals had been in use on these compartments ever since 1937, when the gold was initially stored at Fort Knox. But gold was never in those compartments, just other things, as I mentioned earlier. Nevertheless, attention was cleverly shifted to the old outer vault with the compartments, as if that was where the gold was. Seals were put on doors of compartments with gold alleged to be inside, and these seals were thereafter checked by the so-called annual settlement committees in lieu of actually opening the locked compartments and checking the contents. Of course, for all any settlement committee thereafter really knew, the compartments could have been empty, since there was no way to see in through the solid door of each compartment. United States Mint personnel have recently stated for the record that the peephole through which the 1974 Fort Knox visitors peeped into an unopened cell was drilled especially for that occasion. Thus, they were at last ready for the looting of America's gold. The record-keeping system of the United States Mint now reflected only the status of the compartments in what remained of the original outer vault. Meanwhile, the gold was actually still stored in the completely independent central core vault, reachable only by means of the elevator in the rear. And in 1961, the looting began under the cloak of the London Gold Pool Agreement, initiated that year. Gold began flowing like water out of Fort Knox and the other depositories, arousing the concern of Congressman Frank Shelf and others. But all attempts to stem the tide were brusquely waved aside by Rockefeller agents within our government. By 1968, this gold hemorrhage was used as an excuse to set up the two-tier gold market in place of the London Gold Pool. Further details of the recent events surrounding gold have been given already in my audio book tapes on the coming depression and the Fort Knox gold scandal. So here we are. Our economy mortally wounded by a scandal bigger than Teapot Dome and Watergate combined. And our government is sitting on it with all the power at its command. Our great Justice Department refuses even to examine our evidence about this biggest theft in history, an act of treason, an economic war on the American people. They have more important things to do, it seems, like finding ways to disarm the people in violation of the Constitution they are supposed to defend. The Treasury Department continues to defraud, mislead, and lie about their criminal activities. The General Accounting Office generally refuses to account for anything about our gold in any meaningful terms. And our elected representatives, with very few exceptions, have so far found every excuse in the book to look the other way about the whole thing. Meanwhile, Fort Knox has been completely emptied of its gold, and the American dollar is about to die, according to Lenin's words. Therefore, my friends, I continue to appeal to you to make your collective voices heard and your will felt. I have believed all along in this fight that the madness that now grips our government can still be rooted out and our freedom saved. But I am also convinced that only if you and I do our parts as citizens will this happen. As the toolmaker philosopher Tom Wilson says, we the people need to collectively shake our elected representatives like disobedient children and get them representing us again, instead of the powerful special interests dominated by the Rockefellers. Until next month, my friends, this is Dr. Beter. May God bless each and every one of you. Thank you.